recognise some of its properties. My studies took me to Bordeaux and the Champagne region, but generally it was through reading that I extended my knowledge, and through conversations with dealers and experts over lunch or dinner. It was exciting. I had dinner with wine writer and TV presenter Oz Clark and the wine merchant John Armit. Corney and Barrow wine bars put on great lunches. These men would hold conversations about grapes and years that I couldn't hope to follow. But I was always enthralled. I perhaps ought to have learned more about the grapes. That was the essence of it all. But soon, I was developing a working knowledge. In the autumn of 2010, I was asked about retirement and found myself saying instinctively, "Retirement's for young people, because they have other things they can do." At 70 years of age, with idleness, the system breaks down quickly. You have to have something in place when you retire. Right away, the next day, not after a 3-month holiday. When you're young, the 14-hour days are necessary, because you have to establish yourself. And the only way to do that is by working your balls off. By those means, you establish a work ethic for yourself. If you have family, it's passed on to them. My mother and father conveyed the fruits of their labour to me, and I have done so with my own children and beyond. With youth, you have the capacity to establish all the stability of later life. With age, you have to manage your energy. Keep fit. People should keep fit. Eat the right foods. I was never a great sleeper, but I could get my 5 to 6 hours, which was adequate for me. Some people wake up and lie in bed. I could never do that. I wake up and jump up. I'm ready to go somewhere. I don't lie there, whiling my time away. You've had your sleep. That's why you woke up. I'd be up at 6, maybe 6:15, and be in the training ground for 7. I was only 1/4 hour away. That was my habit. The routine never changed. I came out of a wartime generation that said, "You're born. That's you. You were safe. You had the library and the swimming baths and football. Your parents worked all the time, so either your granny looked in to make sure you were all right, or you reached an age where you looked after yourself. Your basic pattern was laid down that way. My mother used to say, 'That's the mince, that's the tatties. All you need to do is put it on at 4:30. It would all be ready to cook. You would light the fire for them coming in from work. My dad would get in about 5:45 with the table all set. That was your duty. And you would take the ashes down to the midden. Those were the chores when you came in from school. And we did our homework later, my brother and I, at 7 o'clock at night. It was a simple regime, born of a lack of modern amenities. Now we have more fragile human beings. They've never been in the shipyards, never been in a pit. Few have seen manual labour. We have a generation of fathers, my own sons included, who do better for their children than I did for them. They attend more family events than I did. Picnics with the kids. I never organised a picnic in my life. I would say, 'Go and play, boys.' There was a school ground behind our house in Aberdeen, and the lads would be out there with their pals every day. We didn't have a video recorder until 1980. It was grainy, terrible. Progress brings CDs and DVDs, and grandsons who can pull up their fantasy football team on your home computer. I didn't do enough with my boys. Kathy did it. My wife did it, because she was a great mother. She would say, 'When they get to 16, they'll be daddy's boys.' Which was true. As they grew older, they were very close, and the 3 brothers were very close, which pleased me greatly, and Kathy would say, 'I told you.' 'But you produced them,' I would tell her. 'If I ever said a bad word about you to those 3 boys, they would kill me. You're still the boss.' There's no secret to success in this world. The key is graft. Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, The Story of Success, could just have been called Graft. Hard graft. The examples there run all the way back to Carnegie and Rockefeller. There's a story about Rockefeller I love. The family were big churchgoers. One day his son said to him, as the contributions tray was coming round and each worshipper was donating $1, "Dad, wouldn't it be better if we gave them $50 for the whole year?"
"Yes," said the father. "But we'd lose $3, son. Interest."
He also taught his butler how to make a fire that would last an hour longer, how to construct it that way. And he was a billionaire. Rockefeller's hard work instilled a frugal nature in him. He didn't waste. There's a touch of that in me. Even today, if my grandchildren leave something on the plate, I take it. I was the same with my three sons. "Don't leave anything on your plate," was a mantra. Now, if I went near Mark, Jason or Darren's food, they would cut my hand off. You cannot beat hard work. Of course, graft and stress place an invisible strain in the body. So does age. From somewhere in that mix, I developed heart trouble. In the gymnasium one morning, with the belt on, I saw my heart rate soar from 90 to 160. Summoning the weight trainer, Mike Clegg, I complained, "There must be something wrong with the belt." We tried another, same numbers. "You need to see the doc," Mike said. "That's not right." The doctor referred me to Derek Rowlands, who had looked after Graham Souness. It was fibrillation. His advice was to try electric shock treatment to control the heart rate. 7 days later, it was back to normal. In our next game, however, we lost, and my heart rate shot back up. I blame our players. A victory might have kept me inside normal parameters. The treatment had come with a 50 to 60% success rate, but now I knew more action was required. The advice was to have a pacemaker fitted and take an aspirin every day. The insertion in March 2004 took half an hour. I watched it on a screen. I'll always remember the blood spurting up. The device was changed in the autumn of 2010. They last 8 years. That time, I slept right through the changeover. Throughout these consultations, I was told I could still do what I liked in life. Exercise, work, drink my wine. The initial episode did unsettle me, I admit. The previous year, I had taken a health check and returned a heart rate of 48. Albert Morgan, our kit man, had said, "I always thought you hadn't got a heart." My fitness was excellent. Yet, 12 months later, there I was in need of a pacemaker. What it told me was that getting older comes with penalties. We are all susceptible. You think you're indestructible. I did. You know life's door will slam in your face one day, but consider yourself unbreakable up to that day. All of a sudden, God's drawing the reins in on you. In my younger days, I'd be up and down that touchline, kicking every ball, immersing myself in every nuance of the game. I mellowed with age. By the end, I was tending to observe events more than getting caught up in the drama, though some games still had the power to suck me in. From time to time, I would offer a reminder that I was still alive. That message would go to referees, my players, opponents. On health, generally, I would say, if you get the warning, heed it. Listen to your doctors. Get the checkups. Pay attention to your weight and what you're eating. I'm glad to say that the simple act of reading is a marvellous release from the hassles of work and life. If I were to take a guest into my library, they would see books on presidents, prime ministers, Nelson Mandela, Rockefeller, the art of oratory, Nixon and Kissinger, Brown, Blair, Mountbatten, Churchill, Clinton, South Africa and Scottish history. Gordon Brown's book on the Scottish socialist politician James Maxton is in there. Then there'd be all the volumes on Kennedy. Then I have my despot section. What interested me here were the extremes to which humanity will go. Young Stalin, Simon Sebag Montefiore, the dictators, Stalin and Hitler and Lenin. World War II, Behind Closed Doors, by Lawrence Rees. Stalingrad and Berlin, The Downfall, 1945, by Anthony Beaver. On a lighter note, I can pull out Edmund Hillary and David Niven. Then it's back to the dark side with crime, the craze, and the American mafia. I was so immersed in sport in my working life that I tended not to read many books about sport. But there are a few touchstones on the shelves. Reading When Pride Still Mattered, the David Marinus biography of Vince Lombardi, the great Green Bay Packers coach, I was thinking, that's me he's writing about. I'm just like Lombardi. The obsession. I could identify closely with one of Lombardi's greatest sayings. We didn't lose the game. We just ran out of time.
11. Van Nistelrooy.
I was at home on a snowy January night in 2010 when my phone beeped with a text message. "I don't know whether you remember me," it started, "but I need to call you." "Ruud van Nistelrooy." Christ, what was this? I said to Kathy, "He left 4 years ago." Kathy's reply, "What's he wanting? Maybe he'd like to come back to United." "No, don't be silly," I told her. I had no idea what it might be, but I texted him back. "Okay." So he rang. First, the small talk. Had some injuries. Fit now, not getting a game, blah, blah. Then he came out with it. "I want to apologise for my behaviour in the last year at United." I like people who can apologise. I've always admired that. In the modern culture of self-absorption, people forget there is such a word as sorry. Footballers are cocooned by the manager and the club, the media, agents or pals who just tell them how flippin' good they are. It's refreshing to find one who can pick up a phone much later and say, "I was wrong, and I'm sorry." Ruud offered no explanation. Perhaps I should have taken the chance to say, "Why did it go that way?" Mulling over Ruud's call to me that winter night, I knew that two or three Premier League clubs were looking at him, but couldn't see that being a reason for him wanting to speak to me. There would have been no need for him to repair his relationship with Manchester United in order for him to play for another club in England. Perhaps it was a guilt complex. It may have been playing in his mind for ages. Ruud was doubtless a more mature person by that stage. The first sign of trouble in our relationship had been that Ruud had started to mouth off all the time to Carlos Queiroz about Ronaldo. There were a few stand-up confrontations, but nothing unmanageable. Then Ruud switched his fire to Gary Neville. Gary was ready for that and won the battle. David Billion was another who seemed to arouse anger in Ruud. There were quite a few altercations all the way through his final season with us, but it was mainly Van Nistelrooy on Ronaldo. At the end of the previous season, 2004-2005, we had reached the final of the FA Cup against Arsenal. Van Nistelrooy had a horrible game. The previous Wednesday, his agent, Roger Linser, had sought out David Gill and asked for a move. "Ruud wants to leave." David pointed out that we had a cup final on the Saturday, and that perhaps this wasn't the best moment for our main centre-forward to ask to leave. David asked why he wanted to go. Roger Linser's reply was that Van Nistelrooy thought the team had stagnated and didn't believe we could win the Champions League. His view was that we couldn't win the European Cup with young players, the likes of Rooney and Ronaldo. After the cup final, David called Roger and asked him to get Ruud in for a meeting with me. Our position was strong because Real Madrid were not going to pay £35 million for him. That was obvious. And it was the reason, I believe, why Ruud was asking to leave. Had Real Madrid been willing to come up with £35 million, there would have been no need for him to push for a move. He was hoping to bargain with the club to find a fee United would find acceptable. Silly idea. So, we had our meeting. His stance was that he wasn't prepared to wait for Ronaldo and Rooney to mature. "But they're great players," I told him. "You should be leading these young players, helping them." Ruud still said he didn't want to wait. "Look, we're going to sign players in the summer to bring us back to our usual level," I said. "We don't like losing finals. We don't like losing the league. When you build teams, you have to be patient. Not just me, but the players too. This is going to be a good team." He accepted my argument, and we shook hands. In that season, we had signed Vidic and Evra in the January transfer window. Indirectly, those two acquisitions were to ignite the biggest flashpoint in all the time Ruud was with us. In the Carling Cup, I had been playing Louis Saha all the way through. When we reached the final, I said to Ruud, "Look, it's not fair if I don't play Saha. I know you like to play in finals. Hopefully I can get you a bit of the game." I did say that. No doubt about it. We were on cruise control against Wigan, and I saw an ideal opportunity to give Evra and Vidic a taste of the game. They were on final substitutions. I turned to Ruud and said, "I'm going to give these two lads a part of the game." They were going to get a touch, a smell of winning something with Manchester United. "You said Van Nistelrooy." I'll always remember that. Could not believe it. Carlos Queiroz turned on him. I became fractious in the dugout, The other players were telling him, "Behave yourself!" But that was the end of him. I knew we would never get him back. He'd burned his boats. After that incident, his behaviour became worse and worse. In the final week of that campaign, we needed to win the last game of the season against Charlton. With Sahar's injuries, we were walking on eggshells with him. However, I didn't feel I could select Rood. Carlos went to Rood's room and said, "We're not taking you. Go home. The way you behaved all week, we're not having it." Ronaldo had recently lost his father. During that week, Rood had taken a kick at Ronaldo on the training ground and said, "What are you going to do? Complain to your daddy?" He meant Carlos, not Cristiano's dad. He probably wasn't thinking. So then Ronaldo was upset and wanted to have a go at Van Nistelrooy, and Carlos was upset by the insult. Carlos had looked after Ronaldo, as you would expect. He's a coach with Portuguese origins from the same country. Here was a young man with a dying father. If he couldn't ask for help from Carlos, who could he seek it from? The whole episode was very sad. Why Rood changed, I don't know. I can't say for sure whether it was his way of getting himself out of Old Trafford. It didn't do him any favours or bring him any credit in the sense of respect from the other players. It was a pity, because his numbers were sensational. He was one of our club's greatest goal scorers. Problems first surfaced after the second season, when he was up for a new contract, in accordance with his original deal. He asked for a clause that would allow him to leave for Real Madrid specifically in the event of Real offering a specified sum, a buyout clause. I pondered this one for a long time. My feeling was that, without that concession, Van Nistelrooy would not have signed his name. Conversely, to concede that ground would give him a controlling hand. We ran the risk of losing him the following season. So the figure we inserted was 35 million, which, we thought, would deter all comers, even Real Madrid. They agreed to it. To David, I said, "If they come back next year and pay 35 million, at least we'll know we have doubled our money on him. If they don't come, we'll get the 2 years in his contract out of him, and he'll be 29 by that point. We've had him 4 years. We'll be able to move him on." Fine. But the moment Rood signed that contract, he changed. In his last season, he became a really difficult boy. I don't think he was popular by the end. The alteration in him was dramatic. My brother Martin had seen him play for Heron Vane and said, "I really like this lad. He does look the part." With that glowing review, I needed to get cracking. We went back to see him again, but received word he had already signed for PSV a month previously. That confused me, but it seemed a done deal. We kept an eye on him, regardless, and made our move in 2000. On a short holiday in Spain during an international break, I received bad news. A message from our doctor to say Rood had failed the medical. We were sure we had spotted cruciate ligament damage. PSV disagreed, insisting that all their tests had shown only minor ligament disruption, of the kind that would not prevent him passing the examination. Mike Stone, however, would not sign it off, so we sent him back to PSV, who sent him back into training and filmed it for our benefit. In the practice session, Rood's knee completely went. The footage found its way onto TV, where you could see him screaming. What should we do? "These days, if you have the right people looking after you, you can be back from this kind of injury in a few months," I told Martin Edwards. Van Nistelrooy followed the trusted route to Dr. Richard Stedman in Colorado and was out for almost a year. He returned towards the tail end of that season, and we signed him in 2001, after I'd been to watch him against Ajax. His mobility was not impaired, and his pace had not diminished. He wasn't the quickest striker. He was a galloper, who had a quick brain in the penalty box. I'd also been to see him at his home while he was convalescing, and had told him we would still be taking him to Old Trafford, irrespective of his injury. That was an important message for him, because I don't think he was the most confident lad at that point in his career. He was a country boy. He was a typical old-fashioned Italian-type centre-forward. Forget all that running out to the wings and tackling. Back in the early 1960s, Juventus had a centre-forward called Pietro Anastasi, who would contribute little in games before winning them with sudden goal-scoring bursts. That was the kind of centre-forward who dominated the game in that era. You left them to do their work in the penalty box. Van Nistelrooy was from that template. Opportunities had to be created for him, but he was a flawless finisher who scored some true poacher's goals. In fact, he was one of the most selfish finishers I ever saw. His personal goal tally was his guiding obsession. That single-mindedness gave him the edge of a great assassin. He had no interest in build-up play or how many yards he had run in a game, how many sprints he had made. The only aspect he was ever interested in was, how many goals did Ruud van Nistelrooy score? He was superb at the early hit. He would dart to the side of the defender and deliver that quick, lethal strike. If you put my great goal scorers together, Andy Cole, Eric Cantona, Van Nistelrooy, Rooney, Ruud was the most prolific. But the best natural finisher was Solskjaer. Van Nistelrooy scored some magnificent goals, but many were scabby, six-yard box goals. Andy Cole scored some fine goals too, but plenty were close in, scrambled, off the leg, just get-it-in goals. Solskjaer's finishing, though, could be majestic. His thought processes underpinned his skills. He had that analytical mind. As soon as he arrived in a shooting position, he had it all sized up. He had mental pictures everywhere. Yet he didn't play all the time because he wasn't the most aggressive of strikers. He developed more of that later, but was a slender young man without the physique in his early days to clear a path. In games, sitting on the bench, and in training sessions, he would make notes, always. So by the time he came on, he had analysed who the opponents were, what positions they were assuming. He had those images all worked out. The game was laid out for him like a diagram, and he knew where to go and when. Ollie was a sweet-natured boy, who was never looking to be confrontational with me. There was no risk to my office door from Ollie wanting to smash it down, to demand a place in the first 11. We knew he was content with his role, and that helped us. Because if we had a difficult decision to make about the other three strikers, which one to leave out, the fourth was content to play a supporting part. So we just had the three grumpy forwards to deal with, York, Cole and Sheringham. At first, I believed Ruud's range of attributes was wider than it turned out to be. I expected to see from him more of the donkey work that Manchester United players have to do. There were times when he did his share and would apply himself to it, but he was not inclined to be that kind of industrious player. He wasn't endowed with great stamina. His test results were never startling. Yet, you knew he could always put the ball in the net if you fed it into his path. In the preceding years, we had lost Cantona. Teddy Sheringham had gone. Ollie was having his knee problems. Yorkie had lost a bit of focus. And Andy was still fit, fresh. You could always rely on Andy. But I knew when I took Van Nistelrooy on, I was bound to have problems with Cole, because he thought he was the best centre-forward in the world. I say this affectionately because it was a useful self-image to have, but he was miffed when I started pairing him with Ruud. Displeasure had been apparent too in Andy's relationship with Cantona. The only colleague he really related to was Yorkie. Their season in 1998-1999 was made in heaven. Their partnership, their friendship was phenomenal. They hadn't known one another when Yorkie came to the club, but they just gelled. In training, they would work on runs together, little dummies, 1-2s. They synchronised beautifully. I think they scored 53 goals between them. Pairing up with Van Nistelrooy wasn't going to work for Andy, so I sold him to Blackburn Rovers. He was in his early 30s by that point, and we felt we'd had some fine years out of him. We signed him in 1995, got 7 years out of him, and received £6.5 million from Blackburn. His cost from Newcastle had been £7 million, plus Keith Gillespie, who was worth no more than £1 million. So we almost recovered our money after 7 years of productivity. Not bad. Another striker who ran up against the problem of Ruud's singularity was Forlan, a grand player. Ruud wanted to be the number one finisher. That was his nature. Diego Forlan didn't register on his radar at all. So when you put the two of them out there together, there was zero chemistry. Diego was better with a partner, but he scored some priceless goals. Two at Anfield, a goal with the last kick of the game against Chelsea. He was a good player and a terrific pro. The other complication I had with him was that his sister was an invalid in Mallorca, and it fell to him to look after her. But he was great about the place, always smiling, spoke five languages, a breath of fresh air as a person. We let him go for $2 million, which I thought was too cheap. With his wages, no club was willing to bid any higher. The next thing we knew, he was moving on for $15 million. He floated over the ground. He was small, but had a good upper body. Tough. He was such a good tennis player that he might have become a pro and had to choose between that and football. I knew that when he joined. During our pre-season tennis tournament, I tried to get a bet on him. I said to Gary Neville, who ran the book, "What price is Diego?"
"Why?"
"Why?" said Gary, alarmed. "Does he play?" "How would I know?" I said. "Why don't you ask him?" But Gary was already on to me. There would be no betting on Diego. He slaughtered them all. Cut them to ribbons. "You think we're stupid, don't you?" Neville said. I said, "Well, it was worth a try. I was hoping you'd say 10-1. 12. Mourinho, the special rival. The first time I recognised Jose Mourinho as a potential threat was at his opening press conference as Chelsea manager in the summer of 2004. "I'm the special one," Jose announced. "What a cheeky young sod," I thought, as I watched him entertain the press with richly quotable material. An internal voice told me, "New kid in the block. Young. No point in discussing him. No point in taking him on. But he's got the intelligence, the confidence, to deal with a Chelsea job." I had spoken to Carlos a lot about Jose, and he had told me, "He is a very clever boy." His knowledge of Mourinho stretched back to a time they had shared in academia. Jose was one of Carlos's students in Portugal. "My best student by far." "By far," Carlos told me. Forearmed with that knowledge, I watched him ride the wave of expectation he had created for himself, the wave that carried him from Porto to London to work for Roman Abramovich. Jose was one of those guys on a surfboard who can stay longer on the wave than anyone else. I knew straight away it would be unwise to engage him in psychological conflict. I would find another way to tackle him. In the period from August 2004 to May 2006, we won one trophy, the 2006 League Cup. Chelsea and Jose won the Premier League in both those campaigns. As Arsenal dropped away, Abramovich's wealth and Jose's managerial ability became the biggest obstacle to our rebuilding. Traditionally, our preparation for a new season had emphasised the second half of the 38-game programme. We always finished strongly. There was science as well as spirit behind our talent for winning games in the months that really mattered. Jose was fresh in town, working for an employer with stacks of money and with hype clearing his path. In the autumn of 2004, he needed to make a strong start in his first weeks at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea skated to a 6-point lead, and we could never make it up. Once they hit the front in the title race, Jose made sure they won plenty of games narrowly. It was all 1-0 and 2-0 victories. They would take the lead in games and then consolidate. Chelsea were becoming an incredibly hard team to break down. They were much better organised than before. I didn't win a game at Stamford Bridge after Mourinho arrived. Jose puts in lots of pre-season work in the defensive shape and played initially with a back three. Two wide men and a midfield diamond. Very hard to play against that formation. Our first encounter had been the 2003-2004 Champions League campaign, when Jose's Porto knocked us out. I had a spat with him at the end of the first leg, but I often had disagreements with fellow managers when first running into them. Even George Graham and I clashed after our first meeting when George was at Arsenal. Later, we became good friends. The same is true of Mourinho. I always found him very helpful and very communicative. I think he realised he was dealing with someone who had experienced all the emotional extremes in the game and enjoyed our conversations. My indignation in that first leg stemmed from all the diving his Porto players were doing. I think he was a bit taken aback by my anger. I went too far. There was no need for me to vent my feelings on Jose. I was more angry with Keane for being sent off. Playing in my mind was the knowledge that Martin O'Neill had complained about the conduct of Jose's players in the UEFA Cup final between Porto and Celtic, which Porto won. There was a seed in me. I had watched that final, but didn't think they were atypical of a Portuguese team. But when Martin O'Neill kept on and on about it, I started to persuade myself that Jose's team were cynical. My first impression in the away leg was that Roy had been the victim of a refereeing misjudgment. On review, it was clear he'd tried to leave his mark on their goalkeeper. That reduced us to 10 men and meant Keane was suspended for the return leg. In the Old Trafford leg, the referee behaved bizarrely. We attacked 3 or 4 minutes before the end of the game. Ronaldo beat the fullback and he chopped him down. The linesman flagged, but the Russian referee played on. Porto went to the other end and scored. I congratulated Jose at the end of that match. When a team knock you out, it's imperative to find a way to say, all the best. We had a glass of wine, and I told him, you were lucky, but good luck in the next leg. The next time he appeared at Old Trafford, he brought a bottle of his own wine, a Barcavelia, and that started a tradition. The wine at Chelsea was awful, which I could never understand. I said to Abramovich once, that's paint stripper. The next week, he sent me a case of Tignanello, a great drop, one of the best. As for Josie's gallop along the touchline at Old Trafford, I've done it myself. I think back to when we scored against Sheffield Wednesday and Brian Kidd was on the pitch, on his knees, with me rejoicing on the touchline. I admire people who show you their emotions. It shows you they care. And that Champions League victory over United launched Josie. Beating Celtic in a UEFA Cup final was an achievement, but defeating Manchester United at Old Trafford and then going on to win the European Cup was a fuller demonstration of his talent. I remember saying to him around 2008, I don't know when I'm going to retire. It's difficult when you get older because you're scared to retire. Josie said, don't you retire. You're keeping me going. He said he had other challenges, but definitely wanted to come back to England. He won the Champions League with Inter Milan and La Liga in Spain with Real Madrid before returning to Chelsea in June 2013. Everyone I speak to tells me that Jose is exceptionally good with players. He's meticulous in his planning, the detail. He's a likeable person when you get to know him, and he can laugh at himself, turn a joke back on himself. I don't know whether Wenger or Benitez had that capacity. Watching Jose tackle the Real Madrid job after his appointment in 2010 was fascinating. It was the most interesting appointment I could remember in the game. The most intriguing match of styles, managerial and playing. Every coach who has worked there has had to adhere to their philosophy, the Galactico philosophy. When they appointed Mourinho, I'm sure they must have accepted that they would need to bend to his thinking if they were to win the European Cup. It's like any profession. You bring someone in and suddenly everything is altered. And the authors of that appointment say, just a minute, we didn't know we were going to get this. There would have been a few fans sitting in the Bernabeu thinking, I'm not happy with this. I didn't pay for this. I'd rather lose 5-4 than 1-0. So the spectacle of Jose's time in Madrid held me in its grip. It was the greatest challenge of his working life. He had proved the merits of his ways at Porto, Chelsea and Inter Milan. He had won 2 European Cups with different clubs. Could he reshape Real Madrid in his own image, to his own thinking? From the beginning, there seemed little prospect of him abandoning his most sacred ideas in favour of all-out attack and celebrity exuberance. He knew that wasn't the way to succeed in modern football. Barcelona would attack beautifully, but they would also hound the ball when possession was lost. They were a hard-working unit, a collective. In that spell when Real reached 3 Champions League finals in 5 years, they had the best players. Zidane, Figo, Roberto Carlos, Fernando Hierro, Iker Casillas in goal, Claude Makélélé sitting in the middle of the park to break everything up. They stayed with the Galactico system after that, importing Dutch players en masse, and David Beckham, Van Nistelrooy, Robinho. But the European Cup eluded them after the Glasgow final of 2002. Mourinho proved he could make big teams win, but the question I wanted answering was whether he would be allowed to do it his way in Madrid. Jose was a pragmatist, no question. The starting point in his philosophy is to make sure his team don't lose. Against Barcelona in the previous season's Champions League semi-final, he knew his Inter side were going to cede 65% of possession. All teams knew that. Barcelona's policy was to ensure they were always overloaded in the midfield area. If you played 4 there, they would field 5. If you played 6, they would up the ante to 7. By doing so, they could rotate the ball in and out to the back 4. You would end up on their carousel going round and round and wind up dizzy. Occasionally, you might fall on the ball. Watch a carousel and you will see what I mean. The eyes go woozy. So Jose knew Inter would not see much of the ball against Barcelona, but he had weapons of his own, mainly concentration and positioning. Esteban Cambiaso, his central midfielder, was a vital component in that Inter team. If Messi appeared over here, so would Cambiaso. Should Messi pop up in another area, Cambiaso would be there as well. It sounds easy, but as part of a general team plan in which all the defensive duties would connect, it was marvellously effective. Later, I watched a Real Madrid game in which Jose made 3 substitutions in the last 15 minutes. They were all defensive in nature, to make sure he won the game. But all this came much later than our battles in the middle of the decade, when Chelsea won their first league title for 50 years and retained it 12 months later, in the summer of 2006. If 2004-2005 was a horrible season with no trophies, the following year brought only the League Cup. A new team was growing, but I was not to know we could win 3 Premier League trophies in a row. Our strategy was to rebuild for the eventual departures of Keane, Giggs, Scholes and Neville. 3 of them stayed beyond that plan, while Keane had to go. The intention was to assemble a group of young players who could develop over a number of years, with the experience of Giggs and Scholes and Neville, to assist that process. Now, I can look back on that policy as an unqualified success. Yes, we had a barren season in 2004-2005, losing the FA Cup final to Arsenal in a penalty shootout, but I could see the promise in that showpiece game of Rooney and Ronaldo. They toasted Arsenal that day. We had 21 shots at goal. In the Champions League round of 16, we lost 1-0 home and away to Milan, with Hernan Crespo scoring both goals. Rebuilding held no terrors for me. It was second nature. A football club is like family. Sometimes people leave. In football, sometimes they have to. Sometimes you want them to. Sometimes there is no choice for either side, when age or injury intervene. I did feel sentimental about great players leaving us. At the same time, my eye would always be on a player who was coming to an end. An internal voice would always ask, "When's he going to leave? How long will he last?" Experience taught me to stockpile young players in important positions. So when, on the 10th of May 2005, we assembled a guard of honour for Chelsea, the new champions, at our ground, I had no intention of surrendering to Abramovich's wealth in the months to come. Psychologically, that was a big moment for Chelsea. They had won the league for the first time in half a century and could see themselves from then on in another light. A lesson we took on board was that slow starts could no longer be tolerated if we were to face down Chelsea, our big new challengers. The following season, we made a flying start, though the campaign fizzled out, the lowest point being the game against Lille in Paris, where a proportion of our supporters booed the young players in the warm-up in the wake of Keane's outburst on MUTV about some of our squad not pulling their weight. That was a killer. Roy had exacerbated the problem of our poor form by making targets of his teammates. On the pitch, we were in shocking form, and the 1-0 defeat that night was my lowest point for many years. In the same month that Roy Keane left the club, in November 2005, we lost George Best. He was a very nice bloke, George. A very gentle lad, a bit nervous somehow. Nervous to talk to you. He had an insecurity about him that worried you. I remember sitting in a bar in Japan with him once. He was with a girlfriend, and he could hardly talk. He seemed gripped by shyness. George could have had a good life after football. He could have coached young players, but perhaps lacked the personality to be a tutor. A fact about George that few recognise is how intelligent he was. The funeral was huge and sad and wonderfully orchestrated by the city of Belfast. It had the feel and the grandeur of a state funeral. I remember looking at George's father, a wee humble man, and thinking, he produced one of the greatest players of all time. A small man from Belfast. A quiet man. You could see where George got his reticence. The football public in his country is basically working class, and for some reason they like people who are flawed. Best, Gascoigne, Jimmy Johnson, they see reflections of themselves in these imperfect heroes, They understand the frailty. Jimmy was such a likeable lad, you could never fail to be amused by his mischief. Jockstein would stare at his telephone every Friday night, and his wife Jean would say, "What are you looking at the telephone for?" "It's going to ring," Jock would say. "The phone's going to ring." A typical call would start,
"Lanarkshire Police here, Mr. Steen. We've got young Jimmy here."
George Best, of course, was one of United's great European Cup winners. But we were a long way off that pinnacle in this campaign. Wayne Rooney was sent off in a 0-0 draw at Villarreal in September 2005 for sarcastically clapping Kim Milton-Nielsen, who had also dismissed David Beckham in the 1998 World Cup. Not my favourite referee. Nielsen was one of the most infuriating match officials. You were petrified when you saw his name in the list. On another occasion, Rooney swore at Graham Paul 10 times. Paul, who could have sent him off, probably enjoyed having the TV cameras on him. But at least he had the common sense to handle Wayne as a human being and not be bothered by his effing and jeffing. In that respect, Rooney would have more respect for Paul than he would for Nielsen. That was the game in which Heinze ruptured his knee ligament after his agent had asked us for a transfer. Meanwhile, after we'd been knocked out of the Champions League with a 2-1 defeat at Benfica in December, the press were rolling out the sell-by-date theory. To be criticised for continual negligence in the job would have made sense to me. But the suggestion was that I had lost it because of my age, which was disgusting. As people grow older, they gain experience. There was a phase in football when top players were being hired as Premier League managers straight away with no apprenticeship. Managers with experience were tossed aside. Look at Bobby Robson, who was pushed out by Newcastle. Sam Allardyce, a proven manager, was given 6 months at the same club. Ridiculous. Having to face the press on a Friday was galling. None would ask me to my face, "Aren't you past your sell-by date?" But they would write it. They would use the power of the pen to destroy a manager. Momentum had its own logic. Supporters would say, "What they're reporting is right, you know. I've been saying that for years." I knew where they were going. I knew we needed a bit of time. Not too much, because at that time in my career, I wouldn't have been granted unlimited leeway. Had I not felt I was on the verge of building another good team, I would have walked of my own volition. I was confident in Rooney and Ronaldo. I was sure the scouting structure was strong. Players would be found to take us back to our natural level. Though we only won the League Cup, there were some good performances in 2006. Our form recovered after the Benfica defeat, with wins against Wigan, Aston Villa, West Brom and Bolton, which left us 9 points behind Chelsea in the league. Then Evra and Vidic joined. At the back, we practised defensive drills almost every week, especially with crosses, position, attacking the ball, movement of strikers against them, with the full-backs coming into it. We would start off at the centre circle, with two strikers and two sets of wide players, right and left. We'd start off by knocking the ball up to one of the strikers, who would have a shot. As soon as that happened, a second ball would be played out to the side position, from where they would cross, and then a third ball would come from the edge of the box back in again. So they had to react to the shot, the first cross, and the ball coming into the box. 3 tests in 1. The culture of our game has changed. How many centre-halves can you name who actually like defending? Vidic liked it. He loved the challenge of sticking his head in there. You could tell that the thrill of contesting those 50-50 balls animated him. Smalling is a bit like that. He enjoys defending. Vidic was a dour, uncompromising sod. He was a proud Serb. In 2009, he came to see me to say he might be getting called up. "What do you mean, called up?" I said, alarmed. "Kosovo, I am going," he said. "It's my duty." He had the eyes for it. The search for new talent crossed continents and frontiers. Gerard Piqué was one we picked out at a youth tournament. The door to good young Barcelona players had been opened by Arsenal's acquisition of Cesc Fabregas, so we were sure of our ground in dealing with the Piqué family. Our problem was that the player's grandfather had been a member of the Nou Camp ruling hierarchy. Gerard's family were embedded in Barcelona's history. Equally, they had changed the first-team coach several times, so there was flux. Piqué was a terrific player, and I was deeply disappointed when he told us he wanted to move back to Spain. He was an exceptional passer of the ball, and a great personality with a winning mentality. His family are all winners. They are successful people. That's shown from his mother and father. Unfortunately, he didn't want to wait for Ferdinand and Vidic to fall apart. That was my problem. Piqué and Evans would have made a fine partnership for the next 10 years. When we played Barcelona in the Champions League semi-final and drew 0-0, Gerard's father came to see me in the team hotel. They were really lovely people, and explained that Barcelona would like to take his son back. His parents were also keen to see him come home. They missed him. And Gerard was missing first-team football and believed he could earn a starting place at Barcelona. It was all straightforward. The eventual fee was €8 million. He had cost us £180,000, on account of the FIFA regulations in place at the time. The big clubs in Europe subsequently raised their barriers to stop English raids. They were never likely to allow the likes of Piqué and Fabregas to leave the country year after year. At our end, spotting young talent in England, we would have paid £5 million for a first-team player. But why were we asked to pay £500,000 for one who subsequently failed to make the grade? Richard Eckersley was an interesting case. Burnley offered us £500,000 for him. We wanted £1 million. We'd spent 12 years developing the boy. The compensation should really kick in when the player makes the first team. I don't think the selling club would complain, especially with a sell-on clause. We are all subject to errors of judgment, and I made a few in those years, with Cleberson, Jemba Jemba, and so on. I was castigated right to the end over Ralph Milne, and he cost me £170,000. I get pelters for that. The coaching staff would tease me. We need another Ralphie Milne, boss. All my staff had been with me for 20 years plus. They don't forget. William Prunier was another one I was mocked for. Even Patrice Evra, in that high-pitched way, said to me one day, "Boss, did you have William Prunier?" Ryan Giggs's face dropped as he waited for the response. "Aye, we had him on trial once," I snapped. "On trial?" Evra squeaked back. He was not going to let it drop. "How long?" "Two games."
"A two-game trial?"
"Yes, and it was a disaster." Patrice had found the target. The first thing you do with a new player is help him settle. Banking, housing, language, transport and so on. There is a process. Language is always the biggest barrier. Valencia's grasp of English, for example, was a problem. With Antonio, it was purely a confidence issue. I can write and read in French, but I lack the confidence speaking it. Antonio knew this. "How's your French?" he said one day. Point taken. But I did point out to him that had I been working in France, I would have made an effort to speak the language. Valencia was working in England, so the same applied to him. As a player, though, he was as brave as hell. You couldn't intimidate Valencia. He's a boy from the favela. He's obviously scrapped in his life, tough as anything. In a 50-50, he would be right in there, arms across the opponent. Another marquee signing in the summer of 2006 was Michael Carrick. We had admired Carrick for a while, and David Gill was receiving feedback from Spurs that they might be willing to sell. "What value would you put on him?" asked David. "If you got him for £8 million, you'd be doing well," I said. I'll always remember the words David came back with. "Daniel Levy says you'll have to go a bit north before they can accept it." We haggled for weeks. We had watched Michael playing against Arsenal at the end of the season, and Martin told me, "He's definitely a Manchester United player." He was a star man. I think the initial fee was £14 million, with clauses running to £18 million. Michael was a natural passer of the ball at a time when Scholes was inching towards his mid-30s. What impressed me about Carrick was that he was always looking to play that forward pass. His range was expansive, and he could switch the play. The long passes were the ones I felt we could utilise with the players we had. After a couple of months, we told him we couldn't understand why he had not yet scored for us. In training, he struck the ball well, but in games he was not a threat from shooting positions. We improved him in that department. We offered him more freedom and tried to release strengths he was perhaps unaware he had. Maybe he had been in a routine at Spurs, where he was the deeper midfield player and seldom found his way into the box. With us, he found new qualities in his game. He's a fine player, Michael. He was a shy boy who needed to be shaken at times. He doesn't start seasons particularly well, for reasons we struggle to understand, and which we talked to him about, but generally came right about the end of October. There is a casualness about him that causes people to misunderstand his value and his constitution. As I left, Mourinho returned to Chelsea, who, in an earlier phase, were home to my favourite foreign player in the Premier League. Outside United, of course. Gianfranco Zola was a marvel. I will always remember a goal he scored against us at Stamford Bridge, when he drew his foot back to shoot and then paused before the execution. While Zola was devising his artistic finish, Big Pally came sliding in and carried on going while Zola dragged it back. Oh, the stick Pally got that day. One of the lads said, "Any chance of you staying on your feet?" But I loved Zola because he played with a smile. 13. Competing with Wenger. You're not the same on the battlefield as you are in church. Away from the game, Arsene Wenger is a cool customer. He's good company and has a broad spread of conversational topics. We can talk about wine and other things in life. In UEFA gatherings, he made it his business to help other managers. He's a conscientious member of our trade. But when it comes to his team, to match day, he is a completely different animal. I've always felt I could understand Arsene. I could identify with the sharp change in him when that whistle blew. There was a bit of that in me too. If we shared one characteristic, it was an absolute hatred of losing. When I lost to Raith Rovers early in my career at St Mirren, they were putting lumps out of us. I refused to shake hands with Bertie Payton, the Raith Rovers manager, who was my great mate and accomplice on the pitch at Dunfermline. Well, Bertie ran after me to remonstrate. Oh, aye. Sometimes you need a wee lesson that you're wrong, and I was wrong that day. It was a small reminder that life's bigger than the game. When you behave that way, it's petty and lacks dignity. By the end, Arsene and I were on very friendly terms. We had survived together and respected each other's efforts to play good football. But we had conflicts down the years. The opening shot was him complaining about me complaining about the fixture list. A complaint about a complaint. So I fired back with a crafted put-down. "He's just arrived from Japan. What does he know about it?" Which was true. For the next 2 years, it was Arsene complaining about congestion in our fixture list. A foreign coach who comes in and thinks he can play 55 games a season in our league without adjusting is kidding himself. It's a grueling, energy-sapping league. That's why, in the modern game, you have to change the team to spread the load. Arsene learned to adapt to that culture. He overcame the early shock of playing Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday. The first time his Arsenal side played us at Old Trafford, he came into my office. Our relationship was fine at first. The problem started when he lost a game with one of his good Arsenal sides. He found it hard to accept fault in his team and looked to blame the opponent. He would often do it by concentrating on physical challenges. It was hard for him to accept that opponents might adopt a robust approach against his men. His interpretation of physical challenges extended sometimes to the very act of tackling. He would fix in his mind the idea that no one should actually be tackling his boys. I watched his best Arsenal teams, though, and was thrilled. I always liked watching Arsene's sides. Playing against them presented special challenges that I burned many hours thinking about. I always felt I had to examine everything Arsenal did because they presented so many threats across the park. Chelsea presented a different set of problems. There we would be facing experienced players who knew every trick in the book. Arsenal, on the other hand, played the right way. They had one of the worst disciplinary records in football in Arsene's early years, but you could never say they were dirty players or a dirty team. Steve Bould and Tony Adams would kick the life out of you. Everyone knew that. They would come through the back of you all the time. But, in essence, his teams were never filthy. Volatile and macho would be a more accurate term. They were a combative bunch. Bold and Adams, I've mentioned. Then they bought Patrick Vieira, a big competitor who could mix it, get about people. And Nigel Winterburn was a bit of a narc, always chipping away. Ian Wright, their leading striker in those early days, also had a nasty streak. In 2010, Arsene delivered a surprising criticism of Paul Scholes, telling reporters he had a dark side. There was no reason for him to pronounce on one of my players. We were not due to play Arsenal that week, and there had been no friction between us. At that time, Paul Scholes had won 10 Premier League titles and a European Cup. And there was Arsene discussing his dark side. Baffling.
Players surprise you. They can surprise you in the level of performance they rise to and the levels to which they sink. Arsene struggled to accept that as a contributing factor in a defeat. Football brings out the best and the worst in people because the emotional stakes are so high. In a high-stakes game, a player can lose his nerve for a minute and he can lose his temper too. And you're left regretting it. Arsenal had a lot of those moments. But Arsene struggled to believe that internal failings and weaknesses can sometimes cause you to lose. The explanation is sometimes within. I'm not saying managers see everything, but we see most things. So Arsene's stock defence after a game of "I didn't see it" was not one I used. My preferred line was, "I'll need to look at it again." It was the same basic message, but this one bought you time. By the next day or soon after, it's likely to be old news. Something else will have happened in the great churn of events to move the attention away from you. I was sent off 8 times in my career, and the last one was the most stupid, because I was the manager. An opponent had been kicking lumps out of one of our players, and I said to my right-hand man, Davy Proven, "I'm going to go in and do that guy." Davy said, "Don't be stupid. Sit still. If he takes our boy Torrance on again, I'm on." And of course, he did. "That's it," I said. "I'm on." 2 minutes later, I was back off again. In the dressing room, I said, "If I ever hear a word of this getting out, you're all dead." I thought the referee's back was turned when I whacked him. He was 6'3", an army player. My first clash with an Arsenal manager was with George Graham. I watched the denouement to the 1989 title race upstairs in my bedroom and told Cathy, "No calls, don't put anyone through." When Michael Thomas scored the goal against Liverpool that won Arsenal the title, I went berserk. 2 years later, Arsenal won it again, beating us 3-1 in the year we won the European Cup Winners' Cup. I stayed with George after our Highbury game 1 year. He has this fantastic collection of malt whiskies. "You want one?" he asked. "I don't drink whisky," I said. So George opened a bottle of wine. "Which of those malts do you open for guests?" I wondered. "None of them. Nobody gets a malt," he said. "I've got blended bells here." "Typical Scot," I said. George laughed. "This is my pension." Our first meeting at Old Trafford was a war. Afterwards, George was persuaded by a mutual friend to come up to my office. My word, it was hard playing against his Arsenal teams at the time. When Arsene took over after Bruce Rioch's brief spell, I didn't know much about him. One day I asked Eric Cantona, "What's Wenger like?" Eric said, "I think he's over-defensive." "Oh, that's all right," I thought. And the way he started at Arsenal was with 5 at the back. But when you see his teams now, you can't argue for a second that his teams are defensive. Eric's critique still makes me smile. At the end of the 1990s, and for the first part of the new millennium, Arsenal were our challengers. There was no one else on the horizon. Liverpool and Newcastle had brief spells of prominence. Blackburn had their title-winning year. But if you look at our history prior to Jose Mourinho's arrival at Chelsea, there was no consistent threat to our dominance outside of Arsenal. Chelsea were a good cup team, but they could never quite scale the peak of the Premier League. When Blackburn came with an assault, we knew it was unlikely to last because there was no history to sustain an achievement of that magnitude. Their league title win was great for football and for Jack Walker, the benefactor who brought such fine players to the club, Alan Shearer especially. That was a tremendous time for Blackburn. Experience tells you, though, only to worry about the challengers who have a tradition of bidding for the big prizes. When Arsenal and United were locked together for so long, you knew the Gunners were sustained by history and a strong identity. At their ground, in my penultimate year as United manager, I had lunch in the boardroom and said to myself, "This is class. Real class." At Highbury, I would study the bust of Herbert Chapman and feel that any suspicion of nostalgia was outweighed by the sense of solidity and purpose those marble halls conveyed. Achievement was always there, from Herbert Chapman in the 1930s all the way through. Their dressing rooms are marvellous.
The advantages of building a new stadium from scratch are enormous. You have a blank sheet. Every detail you see in the Arsenal home dressing room reflects Arsene's specifications. He has covered every requirement for a football team. In the centre of the room is a marble-top table